Wonderful.
All right, now let's talk about Don Quixote. First of all, I guess I better echo here. I should ask you, this is such a beautiful book. How did the conception for the book come about? What was the idea behind it? Because Don Quixote is a real classic. It's been around for a long time.
You know, I think that Don Quixote, of course, it's one of the great books of all time, and it's one of those books that everyone has the feeling they've read, but in fact they haven't. Maybe they have a little statuette of Sancho Panza and Don Quixote on their horses, or they know the image of the windmills, but actually not so many people have read the book, at least in this country. And I think that the idea was not mine, the idea was the publisher's, but I think it was a terrific one to present Don Quixote in a more readable form with wonderful illustrations in a format that would appeal both to adults who'd never read the book before and maybe to very literary kids. I'm not sure, but that was their hope, that it would be a book for readers of all ages. And it was a funny beginning of a project because they approached me and said, do you think you could adapt Don Quixote? And we'd like it to be 40,000 words. And the idea of measuring a book in advance and knowing exactly how many pages it would be, I just said, it's impossible. And who could possibly cut Cervantes? But the more I thought about it, I began to realize it could be fascinating to figure out what's the real essence of this book if you had to tell it in fewer words, still using Cervantes' language. What would survive? What would make it to the final cut? And so I actually got rather captivated with the idea of reshaping it and yet keeping the feeling of the original. And so finally, after having said, oh no, I would never do it, and it would be really, you know, sort of hubris to tamper with Cervantes, I said yes, because the challenge was irresistible in the end, something that couldn't be done, and yet one would try to do. So,
you translated this from the original Spanish.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. And, you know, there's never been, I think it's safe to say, I'm pretty sure it's true, there's never been really an American translation by a writer. There have been probably more than a dozen English language versions of Don Quixote since it was written. And, you know, this was the first real bestseller in the history of literature. It came out in 1605 in Spain, and I think by 1608 was already in English. So the reaction all over Europe was tremendous excitement. It was immediately put into all the great languages. But over the decades and over centuries, there would be retranslations. And I think there's a mid-century American version, but it's very, in a sense, plodding. And so the wonderful thing about Cervantes, the amazing thing that electrified his countrymen, was the exuberance of his language, the mixture of dialect and all kinds of sort of language of fairy tales, of myth. It's very, very lively. It's just, it's pungent, it's spicy, and it has a terrific rhythm. And that never came through in the standard English versions that people read, say, in college courses.
How long is the original version in Spanish?
The original version, compared to this, is 5 times as long. Anyhow, this is certainly the first time that a writer, I'm also a novelist, I'm a translator, but I also do my own fiction, I'm finishing a novel, so someone with a sense of real style, not just going over it to make sure that every word was exact, which of course I am trying to do at the same time, put Cervantes into American English. And I think that's interesting, too. And I'm very conscious of the fact, too, that this book was written at a time when a lot of people didn't read. And that's a funny paradox, right? Because we're back again at a time when a lot of people don't read. But it's different point in history. And at that time, there was such a tremendous oral tradition. And so books were written, but they were really written to be read aloud. They were written for one literate person to read to other people who couldn't read. And I think that comes through so much in the Spanish. And as I was bringing this into English now, the end of the 20th century, I wanted very much to hold on to that feeling and think of a book that could be read aloud by family sitting around and reading it. I think it's people need to rediscover this book. It's really very modern, and it's been trivialized, I suppose, by all the touristic things that, you know, the matchboxes and everything else that people have from Spain. And with people think of it, the first thing is just these two guys on horses riding out into a field, and one goes crazy and attacks a bunch of windmills. And it's so, so much more sophisticated and surprising than that, because when I began to reread it, and as I said, have to eliminate certain things and figure out what is really the essence of this book that should be preserved, it's someone seduced by imagination. And it's someone whose vision is so strong that every contact with reality fails to convince him that what he's seeing in his mind isn't real. What's in his mind is much more real. And in the course of the book, every other character is drawn into Don Quixote's dream of what the world should be like, one by one, while trying to convince him that he's crazy. They join his madness. And so for me, the book is about that. It's about how the mind has the power to transform reality, and you could say that he's a crazy visionary. Maybe at this point in history we could use a few more crazy visionaries.
Of course, Cervantes gave us new terms for our language. Chaotic, for example, and the phrase tilting at windmills. I mean, these, we use these all the time. Probably people don't even know where they stem from.
Absolutely, I bet people don't. I mean, and in fact, the way we use the word quixotic or quijotesco in Spanish, it shows, it's a different interpretation of what it is. We say someone has a quixotic character. Doesn't it mean sort of mysterious, strange, unpredictable? Well, maybe that is Don Quixote. But we don't use it to mean someone whose creativity, let's say, is what leads him or her through life. We mean it's someone you can't really rely on. And I think it's natural that it's come to mean that, but it's a shame that more people don't know this amazing story.
It seems to me that Cervantes must have had fun, in a way, writing Don Quixote. I noticed in your translation, Cervantes pokes fun at himself by saying he was one of the authors living at the time, but I think you said something, he had problems with character development.
It's wonderful how he puts himself into the story in the scene of the book burning, where they go through all previous literature and say, no, this is no good, throw it out, this is no good. And then they said, well, this Cervantes might still turn into something, so let's hold on to it and see what he does in his next book.
Yeah, the book burning portion kind of disturbed me a little bit, because it was felt by Don Quixote's servants that he was too badly influenced by these various books, and many of them had to go into the bonfire. But that is a little disturbing, isn't it?
Well, I mean, knowing everything we know about book burning, it's hard to see it as terribly amusing. On the other hand, Cervantes had just been through the Inquisition. He was living on the heels of the Inquisition, so he was also, in a sense, poking fun and criticizing the censors, those who said books should be burned, and noticed that his survives the fire. I think he's making fun of that, don't you?
I don't know. It's hard for me to place this in a historical context. I'm not enough of a literary historian to do that. But I do know that Cervantes had a troubled, very colorful life. He was sold into slavery, as I recall, and he was wounded. He lost the use of his left hand.
He was captured. He was held in Tangiers or someplace. He did, and yet, I mean, his attitude towards the ideas of his time is very curious. He seems to be, he's always holding all of it at once. The book is a complete send-up. And it's not. He makes fun of the earlier stories because Don Quixote loses his mind in the very opening of the book. The first two pages describe how he read too much. He got lost in tales of chivalry. And, you know, he's a character, in a way, you're making fun of in the first two pages. This poor man who forgets what he should be doing, and he just keeps reading and reading and reading. And what is he reading? He's reading tales of knights and ladies, the literature of the century before and the century before that, which is all old-fashioned and silly. And that's, in a way, Cervantes' literary critique of that literature as well. And then he proceeds to make his own tale of chivalry, in which Don Quixote stands for those very outmoded, supposedly, values.
How close is the musical Man from La Mancha to the story?
I've never seen the musical. Well, that's interesting. I actually went back and looked at it on video before I did this, and I was amazed, because they took out, in a sense, what they kept is the opposite of what I kept. They kept all of the sort of local color, the very sort of ribald tavern scenes, there's a lot of stories within the story. And for anyone trying to make sense of this book, you're going along, you're reading, and you think you follow the action. Suddenly, Cervantes opens a whole other chapter that's almost like a buried treasure within the book, another book. And he says, and so they opened the trunk, took out the manuscript, and began to read. And then 10 chapters go on with another story. And Man of La Mancha, in a sense, takes one of those stories and blows it up large and makes that more or less the story of Don Quixote. Going to the inn, there's so many stops along the way. About every chapter, almost, they are on their way, and then night falls, and they have to look for a place to spend the night. They go in, and there's an adventure. So it takes one of those moments and stays in it. And for me, first of all, I wasn't adapting for the stage. Secondly, I wanted to show what was most interesting about the book as literature. And it is a book about books, a book about reading and the world that opens from books. So I didn't take that route, and I ended up eliminating a lot of those internal stories and pulling out, most of all, I'd say, the amazing characters that become part of Don Quixote's craziness as he is going out to seek adventure. Then there's this whole succession, beginning with Sancho Panza, of course, his sort of sidekick, or whatever you want to call him, his loyal squire, who attempts to bring him back to his senses. And then there's the priest, remember, and the barber from Don Quixote's village, and they're all met along the way, realize he's lost his mind, and try desperately to bring him back to La Mancha and say, what you really need is to rest, get over this whole thing, and realize that you are not a knight who's going to save the world. You're just yourself, this man from this village, so let's go home. And so for me, what was extraordinary was to watch what happens to them as they come under the influence of his vision. I mean, I was thinking of very crazy things when I was trying to hold in my mind who is Don Quixote, and I was thinking of the power of any really creative genius or visionary. Take Gandhi, or take any writer or any musician, someone whose vision is so seductive. Let's say, take Mozart, take the Beatles, a leader who has the power to make other people see what they see when that vision isn't yet visible in the real world, but to say, do you know there's something more, there's something higher, there's a way all of us could change, the world could be a better place. For me, that's Don Quixote, the madman who sees what no one else can see yet and makes his vision their vision.
I understand that because of piracy, Cervantes did not succeed financially with Don Quixote.
Oh, I thought you meant pirates off the coast.
No, pirates. His book was pirated all over the world.
Yeah, that's also a very interesting story. I believe that he died very poor. And on the other hand, you can't say that he died without knowing that his book was a breakaway sensation. He did have the satisfaction of success in that way. And he wrote Don Quixote in two volumes, and when he finished the first part, he promised at the end, he sort of leaves it up in the air, as if, dear reader, we don't know exactly what happened to him at this point, but it's believed such and such. So it sort of ends with dot, 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 and the possibility that there might be a second volume. And in fact, another writer wrote that second volume, jumped the gun on Cervantes, as it were, and came out with Don Quixote number 2, really, in Spain. And Cervantes then was so angry that he wrote his own volume 2, but it came out after the other one. And so in his part 2 to Don Quixote, he refers to that other version and incorporates some of it and makes fun of it, etc., etc., etc.
Isn't that interesting? You wonder how, I guess they didn't have the copyright laws in those days.
Well, of course. It's hard to imagine, but there was printing, there was typesetting, but it was all in its infancy still.
Well, did Cervantes have a commercial publisher as such?
Oh, I don't think he had Random House.
No, but, I mean, what kind of publishers did they have in the 1600s?
Let's take a look at it. To tell you the truth, I have no idea who...
Probably most of the books probably were self-published, don't you think?
I don't think it was self-published. I think it was published by... Here we go. Well, it came out under the license through the king of Spain, right, of one certain Francisco de Robles. So clearly there were people who paid to publish books. Don't forget, there really was a market for tales of chivalry, all these books that are alluded to, and there had been, what could we say, about a century or so of books in circulation other than the Bible. And all of that literature was already being printed and could be bought. So there were publishers.
Magna, an important component to this new version of Don Quixote is the stunning artwork by Manuel, how do you pronounce his last
Bosch.
Name? Bosch. Bosch? Tell me about Manuel Bosch and this beautiful artwork.
Manuel Bosch is a fantastic, I wish people listening to this could see the illustrations. He's an extraordinary Spanish artist. He does very realistic and yet somehow extremely sort of hallucinatory illustrations, I would say. And he has a style a bit like a Renaissance artist, wouldn't you say? I mean, it's very classical, very... Very beautiful colors, very exact detail.
Very intricate.
Very intricate, absolutely. And he apparently had waited all his life to do a version of Don Quixote. So I feel very lucky to have been able to work alongside a Spaniard so attached to the work, who lived with it for so many years.
I would presume that it was his decision as to which portions of the book to illustrate.
Essentially, it was Manuel's decision, although I must say we had a lot of discussions about which scenes would definitely be in, what had to be in, and how they were going to be done in the text. You know, there's so many things that could be illustrated.
Did you have these discussions, by mail, phone?
Manuel was living in New York when the project began. Uh-huh. He had been here for several years, which helped enormously. And, you know, some of these are just have to be in. I mean, you couldn't imagine doing Don Quixote without a scene of, say, the windmill. But the cover illustration, for example, is one that came out of a long discussion that we had, sort of about, well, really, what is the book? What is the story of the story? And I said that what most intrigued me was the way in which Cervantes, in a sense, slips himself in as Don Quixote, so that you're really not sure, is Cervantes writing the book or is Don Quixote making up the story and only imagining that there's an author outside named Cervantes? And that's why Manuel drew this incredible cover where you see a writer writing, but the face of the writer and the face of the character under him, who's Don Quixote, it's the same face, isn't it? And the character is on a horse riding across the book, which is the book in which the character lives.
Tell
and all the time during the story, by the way, which is also kind of wonderful, and it strikes me as amazing that 300 years ago, someone would think of this. Don Quixote, as he's riding along, often says something about, there will be a book in which I will live forever. He knows himself to be both a real person and a character in a work of fiction, and he sees himself as immortal. Now, is that his madness? But he was right, because the reader reading this book knows that, crazy as he was right. The book would live forever. How could he know that? It means Cervantes himself knew that he was writing a book that would be one of the great works of world literature. How could he have known that when he was the first? He came before every great writer we've ever read.
Well, he may not have known it. You know, it may have... Many writers have dreams and hopes that their books will always be read and may even express it, because it takes an enormous amount of ego to say, look, I've written something here, read me, you know, to foist your words on to the world. It does take an ego that most artists have this, I think. Other people just don't
have it. If you think of that, then, isn't it true that Don Quixote, in his madness, is a portrait of the artist?
It could be. It is said that virtually any novelist creates characters that are bits and pieces of himself, whether the protagonist or the antagonist in a book.
And also that when you're writing a book, it's happened to me, the characters in that book at a certain point become so real to you that you forget you made them up. And at times you think, I'm going to see so-and-so. Then you realize, I can't. They're just stuck between the pages. That person doesn't even exist. But yet you know exactly how they would speak. And a novelist has to not only have that sensation once, but over the months or years that it takes to write a novel. So you do have to stay quite crazy for a long time.
Oh, I've heard this many times, and I've done this broadcast for many years, and I've talked to writers who have told me that they sometimes develop an enormous sense of depression after they finish a book because their characters have left them.
Right. Can't spend time with them anymore.
That's right.
Or if you can, you can only visit them by reading your own book, which is not the same as writing it.
No. Sometimes I think when you read your own book, the book becomes distant from you later, you know. Sometimes you can look at a book and say, did I really write this? It's because the emotional feeling of writing the book has evaporated. You've lost it. It's something in the past, like looking at an old photograph.
Right. And in this book, there's so many turns of all of those ideas that I think it never goes stale, because it's full of surprises. You're never sure who's seeing what through whose eyes. Is it the author? Is it Don Quixote? Is it Sancho? Is it you, the reader?
Do you yourself have a Spanish background?
No, I don't.
Well, how did you?
So
how did you develop the knowledge of the language?
Those mirrors, but it's I'm sort of a cultural chameleon, I guess. And I went to Mexico during high school on an exchange, and you could say in a way never came back. Although I physically came back, but Spanish just came into my ear in such a way that culturally it's as if I have that life also. I became really bilingual, which is unusual that late in life. But anyway, it was just in time, I guess.
And this is certainly not your first translation. I see that you've translated Isabel Allende's novel, one of her novels, House of the Spirits.
House of the Spirits, yeah. No, I've translated a great deal of Latin American literature, wonderful things, poetry as well as fiction. And Spanish is not my only other language, but I guess I have, maybe it's, for me, being a translator and being a writer are just about the same thing, which is an ability to imagine yourself in another universe, another life.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Is translating actually the same as creating your own piece of work, your own piece of fiction?
It's very akin to it, and it's also very different. I mean, in a way, being inside a translation, you're being, I'm inside the character Cervantes, or I'm inside the character Isabel Allende, let's say, or Elena Poniatowska, a wonderful Mexican writer. I become them as I'm trying to make their work come alive in my language. But there's always a point when you translate. I mean, you're never exactly doing the same thing again. It can't be. And I think there's a point where, much as you love the original, you also have people talk about how a translation has to be faithful to the original. And, of course, I believe that, believe it. And yet there's a point, and this is what I love about translation, you're always going in two directions at the same time. It's almost impossible. It's like high wire trapeze work. You also have to be faithful to English.
Well,
you're writing.
There are translations and there are translations. I was reading a translation from the German of a biography of B. Traven recently, published by a small house in Chicago. It was a terrible translation. And the information was of great value, of course, but it was so awkward. The sentences in English, some of them did, I would have to reread the paragraph a couple of times to figure out what the translator meant. It may have been that the translator just did not have a good grasp of English, and so it was an extremely clumsy translation. But this was nonfiction. It's a little different.
Well, I teach translation in the creative writing graduate program at City College, and we spend hours talking about the differences between this language or that language in English, and there's all kinds of issues that come up. I mean, sentences in Spanish or French or Italian tend to be much longer, and can the breath in English hold a sentence for that long? We try. But if you have a sentence that reads like German in every way except the words are English, but the whole sentence structure is German, then somebody in English trying to read that is going to get a bit lost.
Yeah, there were, in this particular translation, there was a formalism of language that we don't have. Also, but the translator did point out that various translations of B. Traven himself showed that he was actually German. Traven tried to hide that he was German and alleged that he was born in Chicago and this sort of thing. But and I have not read all of Traven's stuff, only the Treasure of the Sierra Madre. But this the writer of this book that was translated that I just mentioned said that if you read Traven's books that were translated, some of them by him. I mean, actually, he was writing in English. He translated some of his works from German and then began to write in English. But you could tell he was German.
Oh, I can believe that. I can believe that. But I have a very peculiar theory of translation, I think, which is I look to other languages as expressions, put it this way, I think our English language is always enriched. If a translation is really good, you're going to get language in English from that other language that's different from what a native English-speaking writer would have written. So translating Cervantes, for example, I hope that while writing good English sentences, I've brought into English some of the incredible energy of his Spanish and some of the playfulness, which simply holds a bit of the characteristics of the Spanish language. I hope someone reading it will feel, this is Cervantes. So you want both. You don't want it to sound foreign. But translation allows English to do things that it wouldn't ordinarily do because you have to stretch to make it possible.
Well, Magda Bogan, to kind of wrap things up a little bit, tell me about the publishing house of Stuart Tabori and Chang. That's a new one on me.
Stuart Tabori and Chang. Stuart Tabori and Chang is a terrific house doing probably some of the most beautiful books physically, most beautiful books as objects, as works of art that are being done right now in this country. I think that their primary commitment, as I understand it, is to art books. They do a lot of books on different art forms, on design, on folk art, and they've only recently begun to do books with literary texts and always are looking for the best artists to do them. And the books are printed in Italy, And well,
but they're based here in New York.
Gorgeous, right? Yes, they're based here in New York.
What is the price of Don Quixote? I don't see a price on it.
It's $30.
Is this aimed primarily at the young people or for a general audience?
To my mind, this is for a general audience, most definitely. I mean, I'm translating Cervantes for literate people. And I see this really as a book for people of all ages, but for people who want to know what Don Quixote is.
Well, it's certainly a beautiful book. I know you've undoubtedly taken a great sense of pride in being involved in it. And Magda Bogan, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.